Right now, time to bring in David Tarachuk and the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. We take a look at the media, stories it's covering, how they're covering it. David is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. His website is themediabeat.us. And David, I have a question some observations to pass along to you that has been developing more and more with what's going on, and especially the coverage of what's going on in Ukraine. And
I can imagine, yes.
You know, and when we talk about media nowadays, yes, we talk about NBC, CBS, ABC, BBC, you name it, Sky News, TASS, you name it, we talk about all the media. One thing that we also talk about, which is becoming an important factor in these things that happen, are the posts that go up on TikTok, on Twitter, live videos, and also the appearance now of a lot of fake videos, some put up by individuals, but others put up by countries. It is really becoming a problem where people are seeing videos that are absolutely, totally made up.
Sure. Social media especially is a great, for the users, for the perpetrators of these bits of fakery, social media is a very good platform to put out that kind of stuff. It's obviously not subject to the editorial rigors of what is usually called the mainstream media, you know, real journalism with editors that insist on double-checking sources and that kind of thing. The areas of social media, but also some of that mainstream media too, is unfortunately being taken in by the sheer volume of the disinformation that is going up on online constantly at the moment. That is a feature of this war. I mean, all wars have been, you know, small wars in various places in the last few decades have been a witness to this kind of growth in deliberate disinformation. There's a lot of misinformation that happens in wartime anyway. You know, the classic statement about the fog of war remains true. But the sort of almost industrialized scale of the production of the phony material that we're seeing now requires us to be, as discerning consumers of information, really careful about what we pay attention to. And I would put up a cry, really, for people to be conscious about whether or not they're participants in this disinformation warfare. That's effectively what it is, warfare on the Ethernet, if you like. If you are a retweeter, a forwarder of suspect material, you're part of that whole disinformation industry too. So I think it's really important that people pause and don't just when they're feeling shocked, because part of the point of the, in fact, the major point of many of these pieces of disinformation is to grab your attention by shocking you, and in a state of some shock, as many people, not everybody, I'm glad to say, but many people feel the instantaneous need to forward this material on. So one of the biggest tools, if you like, to protect all of us, the rest of us, from the effects of this disinformation is that wonderful notion of a mental pause button. And there are things you can do yourself as a consumer. You can pause, check, see what the source of this material is. Try checking back. It's usually been retweeted when you see it, or forwarded on in some form from somebody else. Try digging backwards and see where the original came from. If it's convincing, then maybe you can have some justification for forwarding it. A lot of the time, though, you'll find that you end up with an originator who's not actually the originator of the material. It's something that they've seen online and want to to share in that horribly friendly-sounding word, which isn't so friendly at all in its functioning. There's one new development that's worth mentioning, too. But as well as this terrible physical war going on with the lethal military hardware, there's a software war, too, this propaganda war that we're talking about. And false claims and disinformation about Kenya are, of course, they're rife. So are there tools that we can turn to as consumers for maybe helping us in the discernment process? Well, there are, and some of them are effective, some of them are not so effective. I mean, Facebook, for example, you might find an article that just stinks in your digital nostrils, if I can put it like that. And of course, you can flag it as unreliable, and your report about it could possibly be passed to Facebook's subcontracted teams of fact-checkers around the world. That's provided that Facebook's own algorithm has decided that you're reliable, by the way, if you're judged not to be reliable by these algorithms, then nothing will happen to your complaint. But if Facebook's fact-checking teams, underpaid and overworked as they are, if they decide the story is false, then Facebook will, the company says it will anyway, make sure that fewer people see it in the news feeds that people get. But for those who see it anyway, if it is judged to be dubious, Facebook will offer, just underneath the offending story, some related articles on the same subject with an alternative viewpoint that could be a corrective to the disinformation being purveyed. it's not just Facebook. Every major platform, Twitter, YouTube, Reddit, and others, they have some version of this kind of process. But the point about all of these established ways of handling it, all the separate ways that these different platforms have, each tech company writing its own rules and, as ever, using algorithms to put them in process. These algorithms are, of course, a kind of a black box. Their workings are only known to the owners. But there is now, and this is what I want to highlight, a new initiative called NewsGuard that offers something different. It's not so reliant purely on algorithms and instead relies on experienced and well-trained humans, a team. Indeed, I think they're humans. There are several dozen journalists spread out internationally, but all from mainstream, well-regarded professional news organizations. They monitor an amazing number of websites, 7,500. That's a well-chosen sample, if you like. It's the area of informative websites that account for something like over 90% anyway of internet engagement in the developed world. NewsGuard is worth looking at. It was co-founded by a man who's long operated at the intersection of the media and the law, a lawyer himself, Stephen Brill. Among other things, he invented Court TV. You remember. It brought us those wall-to-wall coverage of trials on television. And just on a personal note, he and I were on a live in-person panel in those days when we used to have such things, along with the human rights and civil rights lawyer, William Consler. And Brill told the audience that I think and argue like a lawyer. I've never really known whether that was meant as a compliment or an insult, but Brill's NewsGuard operation is a handy and easily used tool. It's essentially a browser plugin for your search engine, it's an extension for the browser itself. And so it transcends and takes in all platforms, and it gives the NewsGuard people give a trustworthiness rating to these internet top trafficked sites on the internet. It brings up a green icon or a red icon. It's to advise you if it's safe to continue with reading that piece, or it's red for stop and consider consider going elsewhere. Yeah, and then if you hover on the icon, it will bring up for you what NewsGuard call their advisory nutrition label, rather like a can of beans, with point-by-point descriptions of how it scored the site and why it gave the score that it did, good or bad, plus some biographical and professional information about who did the scoring. So here's an automatic techie-type tool, if you like. There's an automatic element to it, the speediness and the immediacy which it delivers its assessment, but also at the background of it all, a very human and a very transparent set of informative checks for you to know how the assessments are made. And full details are at the website newsguardtech.com. Every little effort at countering disinformation counts a bit, I hope, and that's my tip for this week.
You know, it's interesting. The reason I bring this up is I was scrolling, and I saw a video clip that had a BBC logo on it, and it had people running, a huge crowd running, screaming, and it claimed to be the fear of war. It looked strange to me, right? And I'm a big science fiction fan. And so I went back, and sure enough, I found it in one of the episodes of the new British version of War of the Worlds. And it was a crowd. And what these people that can do online is they steal graphics from other from companies, they lay it over, then they do their own voiceover work. It's these people that want to deceive so graphically, it's unbelievable. It really is. I mean, I think this is one thing that, and yes, we all wish that people would back check and check and see if stories are true, but people just want to see how many hits they get, how many people come. I don't even think a lot of these fake versions are put for one political way or another. They just people want to be successful and want to see how many people look at their videos. That's what's really damaging. And so many people are on social media now. And you're right, it waters down. And some of the stuff does wind up affecting regular newscasts.
Sure, it's hard for not for them to drip into the mainstream, if you like. I mean, there is some very highly sophisticated fakery going on, which is almost impossible for the amateur to be able to forensically examine. But some of them, like what you obviously saw, was a cheap and easy fake, and a lot of those are spottable. We certainly have to be alert, and there's. There are many examples of it over this past week, and many of them have been flagged, and many of them have been exposed. But you're right. There's such a volume of it, and many of the reposters, and indeed some of the originators, have as a motive, if you can call it that, sheer mischief making anyway, and attention getting. And as you say, mounting up the number of views and the numbers of clicks through, and alongside that is the inevitable observation that a lot of these sites are funded themselves by advertising, and for to get advertisers, you need to have high hit numbers and engagement numbers, and the way to get that is to be more and more outrageous. We know that even the giants of the field have been doing it for a long time. It's perfectly clear that Facebook's business operation the business model is based on the idea of how much can you shock people into an almost automatic reaction and a sharing, that dreadful word again, sharing of material which is highly suspect. And of course, the more you trade in it, the more you send it on, the worse you're making the overall situation.
I want to get your feeling on this. I mean, I think Russia has made another big mistake, and that is they decided to bomb an airport just 70 miles from the Polish border. Obviously, done to probably even seal the deal that Poland shouldn't be sending fighters over. But it also shows that what's going on in the Ukraine with Russia, if it isn't stopped by Europe and the United States and other countries, it obviously will move on to other countries that broke away from the grip of the Soviet Union. So I think that was another tactical mistake by the Soviet Union to once again, just 70 miles from the Polish border, decide to put an airstrike in.
Well, there's much evidence that the Ukraine war, and let's be clear, it is a war, even if Russia makes its media describe it only as a military operation. And if you don't do that, and if you do use that terrible word war, you risk going to prison for 15 years. It's a war, and as I was saying before, you know, it's conducted in terms of propaganda every bit as much as with lethal military hardware on the ground. But some of the tactical errors, quite clearly errors, miscalculations was the word President Biden used for Russia's conduct of this war. We've got a situation, and you know the experienced observers and indeed in some case participants who are writing about their participation in the media at the moment are offering us if you like some attempt to gauge how it might go, and the overall mood of much of it at the moment is that yes, Russia has made serious miscalculations here. They've been getting themselves bogged down already. We're moving now just into the beginning of the third week of this war, and there's a certain it's clearly argued, and it's hard to disagree that the degree of Russian miscalculation has got the people around Putin concerned about what they can possibly do to achieve their aims, and it's hard not to use some of those hoary old phrases about Russia, but it has been known for decades, perhaps a couple of centuries, as the Russian bear. It's a large, clumsy beast. And when the bear gets frustrated, it could lash out in really dangerous ways for many other countries besides Ukraine. You're absolutely right to have that suspicion and that concern. But the overall tone of these think pieces that I'm referring to in the media, the army of armchair generals, as they're often known, the people who try and speculate about how things might go. I've always said, and especially when we talk in this broadcast, it's a foolhardy journalist who tries to make any predictions of any kind, especially about warfare. But now we're at the point where, as I say, both participants and outside observers are seriously trying to figure out how things might be going from this point forward. And perhaps most important, how it might be possible at all to make it stop. That's the agenda for every thinking person concerned about this. Sometimes we're helped by considered reflections with some sensible views being taken. Sometimes not so much. I've been disappointed this week by, of all things, the New York Times, and one of their most senior political and geopolitical and international conflict observers, Tom Friedman, little Tommy Friedman from Minnesota, as he's been known to refer himself. He's made a less than wholly constructive approach when he told us in his regular column, "I'm terrified." That was his phrase. And his headline writers didn't help us much either, just saying that Tommy is really scared. He's terrified, apparently, of what Putin might now do, facing the frustrations that he is facing. It's not, I would contend, it's not a great contribution to our understanding of world affairs to know that little Tommy Friedman of Minnesota is terrified. Yes, but there is. I mean, the reason for such, I would say, sloppy journalism coming out of even, you know, well-regarded outlets is that it's really hard not to feel that matters have taken a very grave turn in this second week of the war, particularly considering the shockingly reckless disregard for civilian casualties demonstrated by Russia in lots of places, but in particular, in the last few days, the attack on the maternity and children's hospitals in Mariupol, a city, by the way, from which we've been now seeing mass graves dug for the burial of Ukrainian victims. And of course, we're now getting to the point of the somewhat stymied Russian advance is dividing up, and now there's choking of, say, seven cities, probably, around Ukraine. Some now in the west, and places that previously were not under immediate threat, now they are, and we can include in that the capital, Kyiv, since that huge convoy that was advancing so slowly and seemed to have ground to a halt, now apparently dispersing just north of Kyiv. And looking like it's taking, you know, taking up position for a prolonged siege of the capital, just as there has been a siege of Mariupol in the east, and altogether, you know, a shockingly reckless was the phrase I used. Well, I'll use it again. Behavior by the Russians when they come to an agreement about humanitarian corridors for civilians to escape the conflict, they're being ruined by an outbreak of shelling and artillery fire on civilians using those escape routes, and we've seen some horrific images of people being killed. In one case, crossing a bridge that was a difficult enough place to cross, but then when you come under fire, all bets are off, and you know the killing of civilians, what our vice president in visiting Poland has called quite boldly atrocities, they're mounting, and there will come a day of reckoning, I'm sure, and. The undoubted war crimes committed in this military terribly lopsided military engagement will have to be accounted for.
And one other thing, when the United States entered World War I and then World War II, the United States and its allies had to fight to win. There was no choice. It was it's a war that we had to win. Now, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, they weren't wars that we had to win. The thing that scares me is Vladimir Putin is treating this incursion into one country as a war he has to win. And you know it's true. He started something now, and if he doesn't win this war, he will lose his power in Russia. I mean, that's the scary part about this.
And the weapons that will help to, I mean, if you're right, that is, the weapons that will have helped to bring him down will be not so much, well, they were obviously the inability to achieve his military aims in Ukraine, taking it over essentially as a serf-like country under the thrall of Russia itself, Mother Russia. It will have been alongside that. There will have been alongside that the not just the propaganda war we're talking about, but the other kind of hardware effects that can be affected by very hardcore. Economic sanctions. There is an unprecedented worldwide mobilization of these sanctions against Putin, and just as significantly his circle of the kleptocrats who are part of his bulwark of authority. One can see a scenario developing in which he falls because he's failed. Russia, generally speaking, doesn't take very kindly to leaders who take their troops into war overseas and don't do well. We can go right back to Tsar Alexander in the 19th century. Khrushchev in the Cuban Missile Crisis was a bit of military adventuring that rebounded badly on him, and eventually he lost power too. So it's foreseeable that this could be so much Putin's own war that it brings about his own demise. That may be wishful thinking, but it's certainly one of the scenarios amongst the various ones that I've just been talking about that is feasible. What it does need, of course, is a Western alliance that is determined. This is a war they have to win. But although it seems to be pretty clear, certainly from every piece of briefing that comes out of the White House, that actual military engagement is off the table completely. And it is only these economic sanctions that are really going to be the effective kind of weapons that could bring about an end to this lethal form of adventurism, which is so entirely a personal mission for Russia's leader.
And one good thing that has come out of this, and it is obviously a nightmare for Vladimir Putin, is now the strength of NATO. The strength of NATO will only, from this point on, not be disorganized, but will be galvanized by this. And he's created a monster now that was basically almost in the throes of its deathbed. And, well, NATO now shows that it is really viably needed in today's world.
Not entirely unassailable, though. It's still prone to little cracks. The mess in public, and it's never good to make your messes in public, but the disagreement between Poland and the United States about how to get those one-time Soviet fighter planes from Poland and into the hands of Ukrainian pilots has shown that NATO is what it is, an alliance of independent sovereign nations. But yes, the degree of unity overall that they've demonstrated is something that, again, must be counted as an element that Putin and his henchmen did not fully take into account.
Always great to speak to you, David. We'll check with you again next week and see how the media covers the war and other things as well.
Look forward to talking to you then. Bye-bye.
David Terechuk with the Media Beat. And if you want to hear the Media Beat online, robinhoodradio.com, click on demand, click on the Media Beat with David Terechuk. You can also go to his website, themediabeat.us, and find out what he's writing about and covering about on his website.